Live from WNUR News, I'm Gabe Shumway. You're listening to the 6 o'clock news on WNUR 89.3 FM, HD1, Evanston, Chicago. It's Wednesday, October 9th, 2024. Tonight on WNUR News, a deep dive into the history behind Northwestern's geology, reviewing the polarizing new Joker movie, a look back at some of last year's most unique Northwestern courses, and this week's NU Sports Report. Those stories and more tonight on WNUR News at 6. Thanks for dropping by. The edge of Northwestern's Lakeville is a popular spot for many students. Whether they're going for a run along the lakeside path, relaxing in a hammock with a good book, or sitting on one of the Lakeville's painted boulders, gazing pensively out at the glistening waters of Lake Michigan.
A bulldozer, a barge, and a bunch of rocks. That was the start of Northwestern University's Lakeville. What is now a grassy, tree-dotted haven, complete with a lagoon and buildings galore, was once nothing more than a small, unremarkable section of Lake Michigan. Not a single person swung in a hammock, searched library shelves, or scored championship-winning goals atop its then aquatic surface. But a desire to expand the academic and research capacities of the university prompted the conversion of this lake area into land for classrooms, fields, concert halls, and more. It was an idea that President of the Board of Trustees, John G. Searle, called
daring in concept and design and bold in execution.
In his speech at the October 1964 dedication of the Lakeville campus. But what was the design exactly? How does one create land from no land? You start with a ton of rocks. Well, okay, 224,500 tons of rocks. Chicago architecture and engineering firm Skidmore, Owens, and Merrill approached the Lakeville Challenge like a coloring book. Initial construction focused on the building of a seawall which ran largely parallel to shore and over 1,000 feet from the edge of Northwestern's campus. That seawall is now visible as the giant painted boulders at the edge of the present-day Lakeville.
You've probably seen a few winter storms in Lake Michigan, and they can be pretty energetic. And so the riprap, that stuff is called riprap, that they put along the shore is intended to essentially stabilize the shore and prevent erosion of the shore.
That's Dr. Brad Sageman, a professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Northwestern and co-director of the Trinans Institute for Sustainability and Energy. Sageman said limestone and related rocks were likely chosen for the seawall because of their hardness and relative source proximity to Evanston.
So by choosing that material, you fundamentally reduce the transport distance to bring it to the site.
Electrical engineer John Sanderson wrote in 1968 that the university initially planned to transport all of the limestone for the seawall via trucks. But after Evanston City Council shared concerns about potential damage to city streets, the university agreed to largely employ aquatic modes of transportation. Sanderson wrote that this, quote, proved to have been a wise decision because had the material been delivered by truck, there would have been some 150,000 truckloads of the largest highway semi-trailers, end quote. Illinois limestone first met its seawall fate on July 11, 1962, when crushed pieces of the rock were shoved into the Lake Michigan waters by a bulldozer atop a barge. The limestone ranged in size from dust to 50-pound rock and was moved directly to Evanston from Romeoville, Illinois, on barges via the Chicago Sewage and Ship Canal the Chicago River, and of course, Lake Michigan. After the core was placed, larger limestone rocks from the same source were positioned above it in a similar manner. A picture from the October 1964 edition of the Northwestern Alumni News depicts that pivotal first day. University President Dr. J. Roscoe Miller and University Vice President Mr. William Kerr watched the bulldozer closely. But despite their presence on that first day, there was no official university celebration to mark the start of seawall construction. And it all had to do with the dunes. Controversy arose in April 1962 when it was widely publicized that the sand for the actual Lake Fill would be sourced from the Indiana Dunes, a treasured natural landmark. Illinois Senator Paul Douglas was active in dune conservation efforts during the late 1950s and early 60s. He urged Northwestern to change its contract in order to purchase from companies who would not source from the dunes. The area of the Indiana Dunes to be dredged was owned by Bethlehem Steel. The Chicago Sun-Times reported in April 1963 that Northwestern signed with its dredging companies before knowing where these groups would dredge the sand from. When it was discovered that the sand would be sourced from the Indiana Dunes, these companies were prohibited by Bethlehem Steel from exiting their contract and looking for sand elsewhere. Wilmette resident James H. Labadie was one of many who expressed their frustration about the situation in letters to the university. Labadie wrote, quote, "One is nauseated, but not surprised, to learn that a third-rate institution like Northwestern plays footsie with an outfit like Bethlehem Steel in the desecration of the Indiana Dunes. It is truly most appropriate that Northwestern, an insult to the honorable word university, bought sand from this bunch of crooks." End quote. But it wasn't just letters. A version of Northwestern's fight song, complete with updated lyrics credited to Pat Walsh in university archive documents, pointed a finger directly at the institution. I will now attempt to provide a recreation of said song, with the condition that listeners understand that this is purely for demonstrational purposes. The song went a little something like this. "We'll blame Northwestern when they wreck the dunes. They can get the fill more cheaply, other places give it freely." Yeah, the syllables don't quite line up with the original, but you get the idea. All of this fanfare motivated the university to enact a public relations program which called for minimal coverage of the start of construction on the seawall to avoid encouraging, quote, "new activity on the part of the Save the Dunes Committee and their followers, resulting in additional unwanted press coverage," end quote. But enough about sand. Let's head back to the seawall. As you'll recall, the first two layers were made of pieces of crushed limestone, transported by barge from Romeoville with relative ease. The wall was constructed kind of like a trapezoid. A design cross-section referenced by Sanderson shows the smallest rock, or the core fill, forming an asymmetrical trapezoid at the base of the lake. On top and on the lake-facing slope of this trapezoid are the larger pieces of crushed limestone. Above this is rock which puts the foundation below it to shame. The cover stones, also referred to as wave absorber in planning documents, weighed over 2,000 pounds.
They were big boulders, you know. They were like maybe almost as big as the Volkswagen Beetle.
That was Andrew Malcolm, a Northwestern alum who covered the Lakeville's dedication for the Daily Northwestern, where he served as executive editor from 1965 to 1966. The cover stone had to be transported by rail and truck from Bloomington, Indiana, over 200 miles away from Northwestern's campus. When each load of limestone boulders arrived in Evanston, it had to be loaded onto a barge. Once near campus, it was extremely difficult to place the cover stones in the intended, orderly manner.
I have a vague memory of, like, there was a crane, and they would pull up a big barge, and the crane, you know, you could hear the engine going, and you'd hear these sort of very, they were very loud, kind of splashes when they would shove the rocks, you know, pick them up and drop them into the water.
That was Richard Cheverton, Northwestern alum and 1963 to 1964 editor-in-chief of the Daily Northwestern. The first installment of land was ultimately finished in 1964, but many of the university's most notable buildings, Walter Athletic Center, University Library, Norris, and others, still had yet to be built. It's worth noting that while Northwestern's Lakeville may have been a vital part of the school's Evanston campus for the past 60 years or so, the limestone that forms the Lakeville's backbone has existed for hundreds of millions of years. Much of the limestone throughout Illinois and the Midwest traces its origin back to the shallow sea which existed over the area more than 300 million years ago. Algae secretions, shells, and dead coral accumulating on this seafloor deposited calcium, which, along with carbonate mud, compacted under the weight of overlying rock to produce limestone. That rock has completed a drastic journey. From contact with the warm waves of the Western Interior Seaway over 300 million years ago, to the whir of a steam drill during excavation, the rapid back and forth of a bandsaw, the tug of a barge, the lifting arm of a crane, and now the frigid, crashing waves of Lake Michigan, where, through sun and snow, it sits, slowly eroding, on the edge of Northwestern's Lakeville campus. Special thanks to Northwestern University historian Kevin Leonard and the staff of the Northwestern University Archives for their vital role in supporting the research for this story. Thank you also to Andrew Malcolm, Richard Cheverton, Brad Sageman, and Stu Van Ormer for their time and insights. I'm Rose Carlson for WNUR News.
In the world of arts and entertainment, every fall has a defining movie. Whether it's cozy, scary, vaguely autumnal in theme, reporter Gabby Schell went to the theater to see if Joker, Folie à Deux, could be the official movie of fall 2024. And left, mouth agape, and question unanswered. Here's the full review.
We come to this place to laugh, to cry, to care.
And sometimes to awkwardly gawk at the screen, I guess.
If you were alive in 2019, you probably remember the never-ending slew of Joker memes, mostly from the edgelord community, fully cementing the Todd Phillips movie in the cultural zeitgeist despite a middling critical reception. The first Joker follows Joaquin Phoenix as Arthur Fleck, a mentally disturbed clown and struggling stand-up comic as he increasingly loses grasp on reality. The often unsettling movie depicts Fleck's six gory murders, transforming him along the way from a troubled loner to the Joker, an angry homicidal foil for the exploited Gotham working class. But even diehard fans were skeptical about Joker's return to the screen.
I don't think it was like necessary, but I don't think it like hurts anything.
That's fourth-year theater major Apollo Umbra, a fellow moviegoer I met outside the theater. Umbra, a DC Comics superfan, dragged along two friends, second-year theater major Zachariah Hani Masood and Marilena Kolokotsa, who, like me, had just finished watching the first Joker in preparation for the sequel. But whatever expectations we had going in from the first movie, Folie à Deux quickly assured us that this would be a viewing experience like no other. The film opens with a Looney Tunes-inspired cartoon of the Joker fighting his shadow as he prepares to go onto a comedy show set. This short establishes the movie's two overarching themes: Fleck's internal struggle between his humanity and the Joker persona, and the at times off-putting campiness used to explore his inner psyche. What do I mean by that? Well, for starters, it's a musical.
Once in my life, I have someone who needs me. Someone I've needed so long.
But it's not your average musical. Foyer à Deux mixes your classic ritzy sound booth recorded songs with slightly off-key warbled numbers from Phoenix and Lady Gaga, co-starring as love interest Harlene Quinzel, sung in real time. The effect was confusion. It was often hard to discern what was happening in real time versus in their minds, a tactic employed well by the first movie. However, by adding a musical element into the mix, Foyer à Deux injected a dose of awkwardness into the viewer's confusion, to mixed results. Kolokotsu wasn't a fan.
I find the musical theater aspect just so out of place. The plot is already not running smoothly as opposed to the first one, because it's just like you never know where it's going to end.
But Umbra thought that the out-of-placeness of the music was the point and, in fact, improved the storyline.
The reason you use music is because it conveys more emotion than just speaking. And in this, I think they use that as a really clear barrier between, like, to blur the line between reality and fantasy in their minds. And I think it's really interesting that it's used in here because he doesn't have that in the first movie until he's introduced to this other love interest. And it's the first time anyone reciprocates it. And to her, it's also a fantasy, but she knows it's a fantasy and he doesn't. But so like the music is like their language with each other. And I think that that's really interesting.
While the quasi-musical love story takes up half the plot, the other half is dominated by Fleck's murder trial.
2 years ago, the name Arthur Fleck hit Gotham like a hurricane.
The trial of the century.
They believe Arthur Fleck to be some kind of martyr.
As a former mock trial kid, I'm a sucker for a good trial movie, and this part of the story kept me rapt. As the scenes inside of the courtroom got progressively more animated and absurd, the camera continued to pan back out to the growing crowd outside, hungry for justice for the Joker, the symbol for Gotham's exploited class, if not necessarily for Fleck, the mentally ill murderer of six. It was this part of the movie, less so than the love story, that carried the weight of the previous film's political message. Hani Masood appreciated this as well.
In the movie, his defense lawyer, who he fires, doesn't even want to get him, like, released from prison. She just wants to get him put in, like, an actual hospital. And they're still so aggressively, like, pushing to get him just killed instead.
So Foyer à Deux has some romance, some at-times awkward singing, and a resonant political message. But how does it stand as a sequel?
After I watched the first one, I was like, oh, this is perfect. It ends right there. That's the end. Like, that's all I needed. Like, I didn't really want there to be a sequel.
And honestly, that's how I feel about watching the movie as a whole. I left the theater with some new thoughts and new friends, but I can't say I'd go back for seconds. If you're curious to see how Todd Phillips ends his Joker saga, it's worth a watch. But maybe wait until it comes out on streaming. For WNUR News, I'm Gabby Shell.
That's life.
That's life.
That's what all the people say. You're riding high in April, shot down in May.
Next up, our oddities story. With classes now beginning for the new school year, we dug into the archives to find more about some of Northwestern's unique classes from last spring. Jessica Watts sat down with Northwestern students to talk about some classes you may not know about and their importance to the Northwestern community.
Regardless of what your major is at Northwestern, we all know the feeling of scrolling for hours on Caesar when classes drop. Trying to find distros that fit in your schedule and won't bore you to sleep is a struggle, especially when it seems like all the classes are nothing out of the ordinary. But what about the classes at Northwestern that are sort of niche? This spring, a brand new class in the Humanities and Performance Studies departments is being taught, Lana Del Rey, Emotional Landscapes of U.S. Settler Colonialism, caught the eye of many students for its incorporation of the 11-time Grammy-nominated artist. I spoke with Madeline Lassen, a fifth-year PhD candidate in the Department of Performance Studies, who is responsible for introducing this new class.
So I wanted to figure out a way to offer a course that honestly could like give me some reprieve from my dissertation materials, but that also spoke to students' interests broadly. Even though this is like a very niche class, like the catch-22 with performance studies is a lot of people don't really know what we do. I wanted to teach something that felt accessible to students.
Not only does this class present an interesting intersection between Lana Del Rey and the notion of settler colonialism, it does so in an untraditional way.
So for this class, I think a much more interesting question is, how do the ethical failures and misgivings of this artist actually to help me identify my own? Because I'm listening to this thing, I'm identifying with it. You know, I listen to Lana because a lot of her music speaks to me emotionally. So the critique isn't outward facing, like, look at Lana, finger wag. It's actually look at ourselves and like, how can we dismantle our own settler colonial desires as settlers and as settler colonial subjects together, like in the classroom, through our interest in this fraught artist.
CESPB sophomore Malik Middleton has also had experience taking an untraditional class at Northwestern. This winter, Middleton was enrolled in Black Studies 327, New Black Music, parentheses Jazz, in Chicago, which offered students the chance to meet with local artists, booking agents, and tour managers involved in Chicago's jazz scene.
Our big culminating project was basically, as a class, producing and acting as the sort of support for the big Leon Forrest panel that the Black Studies department does every year. And so we had all of the artists that we'd spoken to like come in and play and host a panel. It was really, really awesome. I wanted to be in this class so bad. Originally, I think it was only like, I think the class capacity was like 25. It ended up being like 40 people. And they needed, like, they got a whole new room so that they could accommodate more people, because so it was just in such demand.
For Middleton, this experience was much more than just a class.
This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. This is what I came to Northwestern for. I think a school with this kind of prestige and these kinds of resources can afford to sort of push where education is going and like what that looks like and how classrooms operate. It's exhilarating for students, but it also seemed like it's really, really fun and like engaging for professors too. Like, they get to do something different.
Fellow Northwestern sophomore Sebastian Huerta is also involved in a class that extends the usual bounds that classes have to offer. Social History of Psychedelic Medicine is offered as a communication studies course in the School of Communications.
It's been interesting so far, but definitely a strange class and a strange experience. But I think it's important for the university to offer classes like this, because the whole point of college is to really learn and open new windows of things that you haven't, you know, been exposed to before. And I think, I mean, it's not like anybody's taking a class on psychedelics in high school, so I think it's an interesting, it gives you interesting perspectives, which I think is the most interesting, or the most important part of college.
Who knew that untraditional classes could be what makes students feel like college is worthwhile? For WNUR News, I'm Jessica Watts.
Northwestern sports had an eventful past week, with top 25 teams coming to Evanston in three different sports. Were there any upsets? This week, I'm here to tell you more. Okay. Hello, I'm Gabe Shumway here with your NU sports report on everything from this past week. With two contests on Friday and Sunday, the number 2 ranked field hockey team put on a clinic. After a 4-0 victory against Rutgers on Friday, the Wildcats scored 4 more in the first quarter alone against 17th-ranked Penn State on Sunday. They wound up with a 7-2 victory. After her hat trick against Rutgers and 2 goals against Penn State, Ashley Sessa was named Big Ten Offensive Player of the Week. The Cats had their work cut out for them in football this weekend, with number 23-ranked Indiana coming to Northwestern Medicine Field. The Cats stayed within striking range until the fourth quarter when Indiana pulled away, coasting to a 41-24 victory. Redshirt sophomore Jack Lausch led the Cats' offensive charge with 243 passing yards and 34 rushing yards. However, he was outmatched by the Hoosiers' Curtis Rourke, who threw for 380 yards. With that win, Indiana became the first team to qualify for a bowl game, while the Cats moved to 2-3. Northwestern volleyball has had a rough start to the season, with only 3 wins through their first 10 games. And the losing trend continued this past week, with the Cats falling to number 10 Purdue in 4 sets at home and in 4 sets to rival Illinois. South Florida transfer Busse Hazan led the scoring for the Cats with 22 kills across the 2 contests, alongside junior Kennedy Hill, who netted 19 kills alongside 7 blocks. They'll be back in action Thursday at Welsh Ryan for a 7 p.m. tip-off with Ohio State. After a strong 2023 campaign, the Cats have struggled out of the gate in men's soccer, losing their first 4 conference games. After a 4-0 victory against Division III Trine University, however, the men's soccer team may have built some confidence and will be off to Piscataway to square off with Rutgers University this Friday. The women's soccer team was in the Twin Cities on Friday to face the Golden Gophers. The match ended in a 1-1 tie, with first-year forward Kennedy Roche scoring the 1-NU goal, while sophomore Paige Kalal provided Minnesota's goal. Now sitting at a 0-4-2 record in conference play, the Cats will try to net their first win against UCLA at home this Thursday. The women's cross-country team went down Lakeshore Drive this weekend for a meet at Loyola University Chicago. The team finished 3rd overall among the 5 teams in the women's 6K Open with 61 points. Sophomore Jackie Holman placed 2nd in the Open with a time of 21 minutes and 15 seconds. The team will travel to Peoria for the Bradley Pink Classic on October 18th. That wraps up your NU Sports Report for this week. For more information about upcoming games, as well as how you can watch the Wildcats live, visit www.nusports.com. I'm Gabe Shumway for WNUR News. Taking a look into the headlines. Looking to the Northwestern campus, the NU Dining Workers Union have a new petition underway. Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management's James Allen Center is set to close for construction, leaving employees without their jobs. The rock has been painted in support of the cause, reading, quote, "Justice for Allen Center Workers," unquote. In Greater Evanston, a new vinyl shop opened September 30th on Grove Street. The shop, named Animal Records, will hold much of owner Greg Allen's collection, alongside turntables and record players. Hurricane Milton is headed toward Florida this week, but has lowered from a Category 5 to a Category 3 hurricane. This has come on the heels of Hurricane Helene, which impacted the East Coast and as far west as parts of Appalachia. In a year full of elections around the world, Mozambique has been counting votes over the past week. 3 candidates, headlined by Venancio Mondlane, are becoming increasingly wary of fraud among those running the election. The fraud has not been confirmed by any entities at this time. That's all for WNUR News at 6 p.m. For more news updates and reports, follow us on Twitter at WNUR News. You can listen to these and other WNUR news stories on our website, wnur.news. That's wnur.news. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Our producer today is Mika Ellison, and our reporters are Rose Carlson, Gabby Schell, Jessica Watts, and myself, Gabe Shumway. From all of us here at WNUR News, thanks for listening. Catch our newscast on Friday, October 11th at 6 p.m. Now, back to scheduled programming.